Hey, this is Kaylee Moore.
And this is Paul Jarvis.
Welcome to the Creative Class Podcast.
A podcast for freelancers.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Check out Zoho Social, the all-in-one social media management platform for freelancers.
Save time scheduling your content and reach the right audience at the best time. Zoho Social is from Zoho.com. A suite of more than 45 products trusted by more than 35 million users.
There's an exclusive 60-day free trial offer for Creative Class listeners. Sign up today on GoZohoSocial.com. So this is our mailbag episode, which I always love doing this episode because we're answering questions from students or from people who are thinking about taking Creative Class. And it's just kind of a great way to work through some of the common questions that arise when you're a freelancer or when you're thinking about being a freelancer. So we have a good mix of questions today from a lot of different people. And Paul, do you want to take the first question? Get right into it.
Sure. So Lindsay asks, I wish we had like the same, like Lindsay from Chicken, Alaska.
Is that a real place?
Pretty sure it is. There is a weird city name in Alaska, and it might be Chicken. It may not be Chicken, Alaska. I don't actually know. So Lindsay, who's definitely not in Chicken, Alaska, asks, if you're lucky enough to have a waiting list, what tips do you have for keeping your clients happy and interested while they're waiting for the project date to start? What do you do, Kaylee? What do you do?
So a lot of the people that I work with are long-term relationship clients. So it's not necessarily a waiting list situation. If there is somebody, though, that I'm waiting to get started on a project with, I'm pretty big on the following up and checking in and touching base, you know, all those business speak terms for saying, hey, don't forget about me. Sometimes I'll just send an email and say, hey, you know, we've got 2 weeks to go until we start this. I need X, Y, and Z from you before we get started. Make sure your deposit invoice is paid. Make sure you send over any getting started materials. And I'm looking forward to getting started on this project. Just to kind of send a friendly reminder that we have this thing coming up that we're working on together. How about you?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So the first thing to think about is that I would never put somebody on a waiting list unless they had done two things. They'd given me a down payment and they'd signed a contract. So if they've already signed a legal contract and they've given me money, they're probably still going to be interested when the start date rolls around because they've already shown that they have given me money and signed a contract. So same as you, I think the biggest thing to remember, Lindsay, is that the way that you frame it is important. So if you frame it in a way that it's like, okay, we're going to start in a month, but this is a good thing because I have homework for you to do that is going to take you a month. And that way, when we start the project, we can hit the ground running because I'll have all the information I need to get the project done in the most efficient way possible.
Love it.
Who wouldn't want to be on a waiting list when you frame it like that?
Yeah. And I think also if you have a newsletter, if your potential projects and the people that you work with are on your newsletter list, that's a nice way to stay top of mind with them as well, because you're regularly, consistently sending out interesting stories or things that you're interested in writing about. So it's not entirely related to the project, but they're going to remember that you guys have this thing coming up because you have these emails that are regularly being sent out anyways.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right. So what's the next question?
So our next question is from Kelsey. She says, I'd love to hear how you two approach proposals. I never know whether a potential client is expecting a simple plain text email proposal or maybe something more in-depth and design forward. What are the main pieces you include in every proposal? Do you use software like Proposify? Thanks for your advice. So for me, the answer is pretty simple for this one. I keep it pretty simple and low tech. I have a template email. It's a plain text email that I send to every client who asks for a proposal. It has my rates, my process, and my payment expectations, which is like 0, 50% deposit, here's my office hours, things like that. It makes everything super fast for when I need to copy and paste and basically get potential clients up to speed on what I expect out of the project. And it's not very fancy. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I use a PDF, but it's still not very fancy. A couple things here. So the legal contract is separate from the proposal. So obviously they need to sign some kind of legal contract. We recommend the Creative Class legal contract.
We do.
That's what we use in most of the freelancers we know who are in the course use as well.
Yes.
But so for the proposal, I kind of like to think of it as a sales pitch. Mm-hmm. So I definitely cover like, these are the deliverables. This is how much the deliverables cost. This is the process that we're going to follow. But then I also include things like testimonials from previous clients because my goal in sending a proposal is to get the other person to sign the proposal. So it's a PDF. It's pretty plainly designed. I mean, there's actually an example of it. I call it a statement of work, but it's in the creative class as well. I can't remember which lesson it's in that has that in it in the creative class. But really, those are the things. Like, I definitely cover all my bases, but then remember that this is still kind of a sales pitch. So I do want to include things like client testimonials because I think that that helps.
Yes, I think so too. And you do a really good job of that. I love that example that's in the course. So if anybody's curious about the nuts and bolts of that, they should definitely check that out and maybe create something similar for themselves.
Exactly. I've never used any software, so I'm sure some software for proposals is really good, but I personally always just use Google Docs, save as PDF, done.
Yeah. What's our next question?
Zainab asks, I am a generalist. I like variety in the subject matter and types of projects I work on. However, I've noticed a growing trend of specializing in an industry or one type of deliverable, for example, website branding, course design, ebooks. I feel this allows people to charge more and be more memorable. Do you have suggestions for specializing in a way that doesn't feel like limiting myself? I'm not sure whether I should continue to do what I do or narrow things down. My current goal is to double my income, so I'm looking at what I can tweak in my business to meet this goal.
Good question.
So how would you do this? What would be the deciding factors on whether or not to scale down in terms of niche or scale down in terms of deliverable?
I was in the same boat not too long ago. And for me, I noticed that once I started specializing within a specific industry, that's when my business really took off because it was easier for people to remember me as this person who does this one very specific thing. And we talk about this in Creative Class podcast episodes, I think more than one. And so I also had a little bit of fear about, oh, I don't want to be limited. I don't want to get burned out on the type of work that I'm doing. I don't want to get bored and just kind of be doing the same thing all the time. But I also want to be known for one thing. And what I found is that in making that transition, there's still a lot of variety in the day-to-day work. There's still, I mean, even with a specialization, there's still a lot of different things that I get to work on and a lot of different clients who fall within the niche that I do specialize in. So even though it is a lot of the same and there's a bit of knowledge that I can build upon every time I start a new project, there's still a lot of variety. So I think that fear goes away a little bit once you get into it and you realize there's still a lot of different things that you'll get to work on with a lot of different interesting people.
Yeah, I would agree with that because I think that would be my fear as well. If I was kind of working on tons of different types of projects in tons of different industries. But then when I think about the times when I did just like hone in and specialize on one specific thing for one type of person, it wasn't boring. That fear was unrealized because every client is different. They could all work in the same industry and have similar things, but they all have different, even if it's slightly, it still becomes a big deal once you get into the project, like type of work that they do or the clients that they have or the audience that they want to reach. It was always different enough for me where it was still fun. It was still interesting. It was still, and I felt like I could get further into each project because I had that base knowledge like you talked about. And I think it's the same with anything. When you start something, it seems like you only have so much to learn. But then the more you get into it and the more that you learn, the more you realize how much more there is. Mm-hmm. I just think that that's kind of the way that knowledge works and that specialization works.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's very true. It's a very realistic fear. I mean, I totally understand how you could go into it thinking, ugh, I don't want to do the same thing all the time with all the same people. But there's a lot of variety. It's kind of surprising. So our next question here is from Mark. Ooh, another proposal question. He says, once a proposal for a project has been sent to a client, do you have any good tips on how to follow up without sounding desperate? And are there any good practices to ensure you win the job? This is a good question. I like this one. So I think there's a huge benefit to following up and to just saying, hey, just circling back, just wanted to see if you were still interested. I'm booking for the next month or the next, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, and I'd love to get you on my calendar. If you'd like to move forward on this project, make sure to let me know by X date. Give them a cutoff. And that really helps just show that you're interested in the project, that you have a process because you're trying to get things slated for the future. You're not just winging it all the time. And it shows that you are in demand as well, because you're saying, hey, I have other people who are interested, essentially. If you'd like a spot with me, make sure you let me know so we can get that on the books.
I have nothing else to add. That was a perfect answer.
Oh my gosh, I feel so smart.
Mark, hope you like that answer as much as I did. So Lucia asks, I often struggle with deciding my project rate and my hourly rate. Sometimes clients want more pre-production conversations that take more time than I estimated for my project pricing I gave. How do you come up with project pricing when things change on the march? How do you handle those conversations with clients, and how do you price for that? I like it. Mm-hmm. So I think what a lot of freelancers have started to do is charging for those initial conversations. And a lot of freelancers call it road mapping or consulting. And then a lot of times as well, if you charge for that, you can say, if we don't move forward on the big project, that's fine. You paid for the work that we've done together. But if we do move forward on the project, then I'll take into account what you paid for the brainstorming sessions, and I'll apply that to the overall project. Because I think a lot of times, if you're working on a type of project that requires a lot of work up front to get to it, it's just like with any strategy or consulting, like sometimes what you bring to the table is that idea brainstorming session. So I think that it's worth charging for in a case like this, Lucia, where it seems like a lot of the value is those pre-production conversations. So you could even have, maybe even if it's like a day rate or something like that, or there's a fee that has a set deliverable for these are the type of conversations we're going to have. This is what the outcome is going to be. Maybe it's like a document that sums up all of the things you talk about. And then you can say, like, I can quote on this once we have completed this phase of the project. And even if you give, and I found it was helpful for me at least, I would give not necessarily quotes, but I would give starting prices. The starting price for a road mapping session is $1,000. The starting price for website for me is $10,000. So you're not really giving them a quote and tying them down to a number, but you're still giving them some expectation where it's like, if they think it's a $500 project and it's an $11,000 project, probably not a good fit. So I find that that has been pretty helpful, where you just give them kind of an idea of where the pricing is going to start, and you'll fill it in once you do a paid road mapping session. How about you? What would you do for that?
I think that makes a lot of sense. The only other thing I would add is that if you find this is something that happens fairly frequently, is to up your rates a little bit more so that you're accounting for these conversations in your pricing. It might feel a little intimidating to ask for more than what you're comfortable or what you normally charge. But I think you're being very smart about that and upping the rate a little bit, because you know from your end of things that it is going to take a little bit longer and there's going to be some time that you need to spend on the phone. And like what Paul said, tying a deliverable to that, to where you can say at the end of these conversations that we have when we're getting started, you'll have a couple documents or a document that outlines exactly what we're going to do on this project, the steps for the project, our deadlines. We're both going to have a very clear picture of how this is going to play out. I think that that makes it more logical in the client's mind to pay the higher rate, because again, they're paying for you to be the expert and for you to like really know what you're doing. So don't be afraid to charge a little more.
I like that. And I mean, it's a good position to be in, because it sounds like, Lucia, the clients want your input. They want your expertise. They want your knowledge, which is the best place for a freelancer to be in. So I think that's a good problem to have.
It is a good problem.
How do you manage social media without it taking up all your time? You're creating, you're curating, you're sharing great content on social media.
But how do you get the attention and reach your content deserves and engage your audience across multiple channels?
Try Zoho Social, the all-in-one social media management platform for freelancers.
Save time scheduling your content and reach the right audience at the best time. Zoho Social is from Zoho.com, a suite of more than 45 products trusted by more than 35 million users.
There's an exclusive 60-day free trial for Creative Class listeners, So sign up today at gozohosocial.com. Laura asks, Kaylee, I noticed on your website that you send clients a 5-question exit survey after completing a project. I would love to know, what do you ask them and what tips do you have for other freelancers on developing their own exit strategy?
So I learned to develop the exit strategy from when I took the creative class. There was a lesson or maybe a worksheet that said, put together an exit survey. And so I did. And so my exit survey is really simple. It's basically just a customer experience survey of sorts for my freelance work. And the questions that I include are really simple. It's, how did the project go overall? What can improve on my end of things? How could I make this better for the next time we work together or the next time I work with a similar client? What worked well? What didn't work so well? What were the things you really liked about the process? What things do you think have room for improvement? Which is kind of the same question, just asking it in a different way. I also ask, would you be willing to leave a testimonial about the project that we did together? I always throw in a few outcomes that we produced as well. So those things are nice and fresh in their mind, and they give me a really valuable testimonial that probably incorporates those things, which is kind of reverse engineering a really strong testimonial. And then the last question I always ask is, would you be willing to make a referral to similar clients? And I always ask that question because it's a good driver of new business for me. And it lets them know that if I'm looking for new clients or things are a little slow for me, that I'm open to referrals and that I appreciate recommendations to other clients. Sometimes they just need to be reminded that that's helpful. Those are the things that I ask for. It's pretty simple. It's just a plain text email.
You're such a good creative class student.
Thank you.
Those are all the things. Yeah, those are definitely all the things. So Brennan asks, how do you go about client education? Do you find videos, articles, or something else that works best in educating clients about the work that you do? Not getting new clients, but information that lets them know how you work best together and the value of the work that you're doing.
Ooh, that's all you.
I love this question. Well, I also love Brennan. So
mm-hmm.
I think that clients don't know how to be good clients unless we teach them. Because we sit and do the same freelance work every single day, sometimes for years. Whereas clients, they may only need to hire one copywriter once every couple years or a web designer once every 5 years. So they don't know how to be good clients. So I think client education is huge. So I think there's a few aspects of client education. So I think the first is really teaching them what your process is, why you have a process, and the benefits of following your process, because you're the expert and you know how to do these projects. The next thing is a huge part of client education is establishing boundaries. And Kaylee's talked about this too with having office hours, where if you don't set expectations and boundaries for clients, they're going to set themselves and you might not like it. You might not like that they're emailing you at 2 a.m. and expecting a response, but you're sleeping, because why wouldn't you? So I think that kind of thing is really important. For myself, I always had a PDF that just kind of outlined, this is the process. This is why we have a process. This is my expectations for you. This is what you should expect of me. And here's how to go about feedback in the best possible way. And we have a whole lesson on feedback in creative class because it's so important. So having videos would probably be a good thing. I never had that myself, but I definitely had content around educating clients to be the best clients that they could be for the project, because we both want the same outcome. The client and the freelancer, they both want the project to go as smoothly as possible, have the best outcome, and be on time and on budget. So the more that you can teach clients how to do that, the more they're going to be educated, and then the less stressed you're going to be with having to deal with people who don't know how to follow a process, or they're giving you feedback in 50 emails versus 50 points in a single email, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely check out the feedback lesson within Creative Class. There are some awesome templates, Paul, that you've created that basically it's a document that says, here's how to teach your client to give you good versus bad feedback and how to fine tune that process. So that's super helpful. Our next question is another Nina question. Maybe a different Nina, I'm not sure. I need a little bit of clarity around this one,
though. Nina from Chicken, Alaska.
Yes. So how do you know if advice is good or bad and if you should follow it? So my question is, do you think this is regarding client advice or like advice from another freelancer?
I think advice from another freelancer, even advice from people like us who have a podcast.
Okay, that makes sense. So for me, I think you really just kind of have to go with your gut. I mean, people have pretty good BS meters of when people are giving good, valuable, helpful advice versus just kind of blowing smoke, I guess. So go with your gut, lie on what you feel like makes sense, and ask around too. Don't ever take one person's word for it. I think it's good to, if you have a community like a Facebook group or a Slack channel where you can say, hey, X person just told me this thing. What do you guys think about it? And then get a little bit of group perspective. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple kinds. I've been thinking about this because people like Val Geisler, I don't know how to say her name because I always just read it.
I think that's right.
The email expert, Val Geisler, who's on Twitter, and even my buddy Justin Jackson, they've been tweeting about this a lot and talking about this a lot. So it's been something that I've been thinking about because I think I get a lot of feedback and advice from people from my newsletter, just from like being out there on the internet. I get a ton of advice and I think that most of it doesn't really matter. And as not to be mean, but I think that there's a difference between asking for advice from a trusted other person and just getting people who tweet. Like I get tweets and emails from people about how to run my business all the time. A lot of them don't actually have their own businesses, so I'm probably not going to listen to them. So I think there's a difference between unsolicited feedback and asking for advice or criticism. If I'm in a project and I'm working with somebody and they tell me like, hey, why don't we consider this? And I'm going to consider it. But if it's just somebody on Twitter that's like, hey, why don't you run your business like this? Or like for me, why don't you sell WordPress themes anymore? You were making money. You're dumb for not doing it. We actually don't know all of it, like the whole story or any of it. So I think that you have to take into account what the other person knows about the subject. If I ask for advice on my writing from my mom, that would be nice, I guess, because she would say that she loves it because she's my mom. But she's also not my target audience. So like, I don't care what my mom thinks, even though that sounds really mean and makes me sound like an awful son. So I think that you have to kind of take into account the person who's giving you the advice. Do you trust this person? Does this person know what you're doing? Does this person have knowledge about the thing? People like to give advice about everything. I like to give advice about everything. I don't know very many topics. I know freelancing really well, which is why I have a podcast with you about freelancing. But there's definitely some things where I'm just talking to friends and like shooting the shit. And if I have advice about something, I might not know the subject matter all that well. So I think you definitely have to take into account that because not all advice is equal.
For sure.
So Natalie asks, I feel like I was on a soapbox there. I just had to step up for a second, then step back down. So Natalie asks, I mostly do branding and web design for local entrepreneurs. I can't figure out what kind of useful content I should create for my audience. You have some techniques to brainstorm content. I feel like you're the best person in the entire world to answer this question.
I love this question. So I was in a similar position not too long ago because when I was starting out, I was doing a lot of services for local entrepreneurs. I was working with some local clients. And so I was like, oh, well, I should write about social media and I should write about branding and blogging and all of these different things. And I did it for about a year. And it was all right, but it didn't get a lot of feedback. It didn't lead to a lot of new opportunities for me. And it wasn't particularly writing that I enjoyed. So I actually decided to switch and shift my focus and start writing on my new site, kayleemoore.com, about topics that I thought were interesting and sharing knowledge about basically my everyday life, freelancing and writing and working with software and e-commerce clients and really just being able to use my own writing voice and write as myself about the things that I cared about. And so that was a big shift focus-wise for content creation. But I think that that illustrates a really good way to figure out what to write about for your own content. If it's not producing great results for your business and leading to new opportunities, maybe it's not a good investment of your time and energy. Maybe you could have a better result from telling stories, basically just about your day-to-day life as a freelancer or sharing interesting things that you've learned while working with clients and maybe just teaching other people. It doesn't even necessarily have to be your clients. It can just be telling a story and sharing something valuable that you learned along the way doing the work that you're doing. So I think that that's a valuable lesson for any freelancers. Take a hard look at the writing that you're doing. If it's not really getting any traction, maybe think about trying something very different. And Paul, this is something you do really well too with the Sunday dispatches, is it's not trying to really land you new client work. It's writing that tells stories and is you speaking to people who want to hear from you.
Yeah. And I think for that, it's definitely that. And it's me trying to take into consideration the type of audience that I want to have, whether it's clients for freelancing or whether it's just people who might be interested in products that I create. When I first started writing content and I was doing web design at the time, I always thought that it was interesting that most web designers just wrote for other web designers. And I was like, why are they doing, like, I didn't understand why they were doing that. I mean, for some people, it made a ton of sense because they wanted to get like speaking gigs at web design conferences. Then it makes total sense. But I was like, why don't I write for the audience that I want to have and start talking to them about the type of things that they're interested in? And that for me was always like the biggest catalyst for content ideas, was talking to the people that I was already working with. So Natalie, if you're working with local entrepreneurs, find out what they want to know and start making content around that. And I think, Kaylee, what you said as well is really important, is there are tons of different ways to create content. So you may be writing for the right audience, but it may not be hitting the mark in terms of interest, because sometimes it needs a bit stronger storytelling. Sometimes it needs a bit more a personal flair. Sometimes it could need more facts and figures if that's the kind of thing that your audience wants. Or maybe it's that the type of content your audience would be most interested in consuming is video or writing or a podcast. It's not just like a one-step answer. I think there's many facets of getting this to hit all the right notes for the future. So I think it's definitely worth thinking about all of those things that we said there.
Yes, definitely ask your audience what they want. That's a good place to start. Otherwise, you're just guessing.
And think about how they answer it too, because I think that pretty much this applies to most things, but the first answer that people give is typically a BS answer, because people want to be people pleasers. So they think that they're answering in a way that you want them to answer, but kind of peel back the layers of it. And I think good writers do a good job of this, where they listen to what the answer is that's given, but then they think about what the reasoning behind the answer was, right? Even for clients, when I was doing freelancing, people would say like, oh, I really want my website to look great. And I'd be like, cool, I know you want that. But that's not the reason you want a new web. You want your website to look great because you want to make more money from your website, or you want to get more mailing list subscribers because your site looks good. So I think listening to the answers that they give, but then kind of thinking about the reasons why they're giving that answer, and maybe asking them a few times in different words the same question to kind of get to the real reason, can be super important. Because a lot of times people give the first answer and they haven't thought about it enough. But it's like the second time you ask the question, you get the good, the juicy, the real answer.
Definitely. So our last question is from Pinar. The question is, how do you go about searching for clients when you have multiple niches you are equally passionate about? It's easy to get overwhelmed during the search process. So my first knee-jerk reaction to this question is, it's always better to start doing something really simple and eliminate some of the niches that, if you had to write them down on a piece of paper, are not as interesting as maybe your top one or two. That's a good way to start. And that's a good way to kind of narrow things down right off the bat, is be really honest with yourself about the work that you enjoy doing and the people you enjoy working with, and start there and start really taking some time to explore, well, why do you like working with those clients the most? And what do you like most about the projects that they give you? That's so hard to do sometimes when you're starting out freelancing, because you want to make money and you want to make it work, and you have a lot of stress and anxiety about, is this sustainable? And so you don't really take the time to sit down and think about something like this, to really be honest with yourself about the work you enjoy, the people you enjoy working with. And again, this was another one of the things that Creative Class helped me figure out when I was starting out, was just taking the time and setting it aside to think about the answers to those questions and write stuff down on paper, or start a Google Doc and just kind of start getting your thoughts out of your head and onto a piece of paper. That's a good way to start.
Yeah, I like that. And I think I would add to that, because I agree with everything you said, I would add to that and say, also think about how much money you need to make per project, because this is a business. So think about how much money you need to make per project, or how much money you want to eventually make per project, and whether or not that niche can afford that. Mm-hmm. Because the example I always give is like people wanting to work for indie musicians. Indie musicians have money for beer and gear, and that's about it. So if you have a service that costs $5, you may be able to make it work. If you have a $5,000 service, you're not going to be able to sell that to indie bands. Whereas if it was another niche, they may be easily able to afford that. So I always took into account that. And the other thing that I would take into account is that business is hard. Mm-hmm. Freelancing is hard. So where can you get the easiest wins? What type of client are the easiest for you to find, the easiest for you to sign, the easiest for you to get paid and to charge what you want? People are always like, oh, well, I have to do it the hard way. No, you don't.
No.
Even if you do it the easy way, business and freelancing is ridiculously difficult. So why not just make it as easy as you can for, even with like myself, like for projects that I start now, I look for the ones where I can get the easiest wins, because all of the other things are going to be difficult anyways. So why not just try to give yourself a break in like one or two little areas and then be able to move forward with that?
Yep. I think that makes a lot of sense. These were great questions. I had a lot of fun answering these. I think that was our last one, but nice job, guys. Great questions.
Yeah. And this is the end of season 3 of Creator Class.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Unless you just skip to this episode, which is also fine.
Also like fine.
There's no order to these episodes. So I think, yeah, that's the end. We appreciate you listening, and we look forward to showing up in your ears again, probably sometime in early-ish 2019.
Yeah, we'll see you then, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast.
If you enjoyed it, please take a second to leave a review over on iTunes.
And be sure to check out our course, The Creative Class.
You can find it at creativeclass.co, which is creativeclass.co.
Ooh.